The Citadel Cafe is proudly sponsored by TweakedAudio.com. For high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds, visit TweakedAudio.com and use our code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. That's TweakedAudio.com.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 127 for Wednesday, December 3rd, 2014. How the crap is it December already? My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I gather to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, websites, and head colds. If you hadn't guessed, I have one. I apologize if I cannot get to my non-functioning cough button in time. I will do my best. Joining me this week is Hammond Chamberlain, with no D, from Grumpy Cast, from Beyond the Playlist. Welcome back, as always, sir.
Joel, how you doing, other than the head cold?
Other than the head slash chest slash I don't know what kind of plague I have cold, I am pretty good. Seems to be balancing out. I've got a number of Christmas commissions to get out the door for this month, which is always exciting. They're not super high-paying gigs because they're priced for the average consumer, which is what I like. But that also gives the average consumer access to illustration for me, which is really cool. So I've got several commissions for people that want portraits of either their friends and loved ones, or like family members, or even portraits of coworkers for special events. So they're always really fun to do, and that's what I'm lining up to do. Basically over the next 2 weeks, because with mailing and stuff like that, depends. Some of them are local, so that's going to be easy to get to, but people go away for the holidays, so I want to try to get everything out in and around the 14th of December, so I've got 11 days. Dun, dun,
dun. So do you build yourself a vacation or Christmas break kind of thing in,
normally,
or do you work straight through?
Normally I do. Normally I work up until probably say like the 23rd, give or take. 22nd, depending on what projects I have going on and what deadlines are happening. But this year, that is unlikely. As I mentioned on my blog earlier this fall, I've taken a part-time job. So that part-time job will more than likely land me working over the holiday break. Okay. As I fill in for people that are full-time, which is kind of par for the course for part-time jobs. So that's what's going to happen there. I do like to try and get away. And I mean, I've been spoiled the last few years. As an independent creator, I tend to be able to take, you know, from Christmas through New Year's off. Last year, I actually took a full 3 weeks off at Christmas, which was amazing. But this year looks like I'm back with the rest of the masses that will get, you know, kind of Christmas Day, Boxing Day. Because here in Nova Scotia, Boxing Day, the 26th, like nothing is open. It's closed. All the Boxing Day sales, quote unquote, happen on the 27th.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's 2 days of Christmas. There will be, of course, New Year's Day is a stat holiday here as well, so I'll have those, you know, New Year's evening off, New Year's Day off, and that's, I mean, anybody that's got kind of a full-time 9-to-5, that's most of what people get. I mean, there are some people that put in vacation time for the days in between New Year's, but for me, it was always a forced thing, because my clients, as an illustrator, often had the businesses closed between Christmas and New Year's for their own employees, so then as a freelance artist, there was nothing to do.
Just as a side question, talking about 9-to-5 work, it's always been curious to me is how long did it take you to develop the discipline to work from home that you aren't distracted and you aren't
where you can
sit down and actually churn stuff out and have moments when you're at work and then know there's a line between I'm at work and then I'm at home.
Yeah, that's a constant battle. I mean, 12 years in, that's still happening. The issue, it becomes even more complicated when you throw in a creative career in there. So it's not just that I have to work from home. It's not like I'm an accountant. You know, I have to be able to be creative and in some cases be funny, you know, in order to pay rent and do that kind of stuff. And that stuff I've always found challenging, more so over the last few years, as the last 6 years I've been completely independent, this part-time job aside. I've been completely independent from home, so that everything is then dependent on your income and the level of work that you're doing. So that's a big motivator, you know, like having student loans, rent, and groceries over your head. and say like, if I do not do this work, I cannot go buy groceries. Like, I mean, there's a real give and take there as far as, you know, like, if I do A, I get B. And that tends to keep me focused. It helps that when you're independent and having built a career before going independent, I was able to kind of cultivate clients that I wanted to work for, so that when the work that I was doing, I really enjoyed. Like, it wasn't, it's still for clients, like it's still work, but I don't mind. I mean, for example, I'm doing a lot of freelance illustration for College Humor right now. I just released a new article this Monday about the 10 awkward moments that you have when you're going home to visit family. It was released in conjunction with the Thanksgiving holiday weekend in the States. And that was a lot of fun to do. Like, I really enjoy working with College Humor. They're funny guys. They give me a lot of creative freedom. You know, the pay is pretty good. So, I mean, like, it's perfect. It's a great relationship. And those are the kind of clients that make it easy to, in that case, stay up late and make a deadline. So I've not really had too much of an issue. I do have a studio that's not part of the rest of my living space, and that helps too.
Yeah, that having a defined line would probably be as key as anything else.
Yeah. Now, when you do your podcasting, do you have a separate room that you kind of squirrel yourself away in, or do you just kind of shoo the family out of the family room and say, this is my domain for the next hour?
Well, it's interesting. We built a house 3 years ago, and in that, my wife said, what's the one wish that you had? And I said, I want a round office. And she goes, round is expensive. How about octagon? And I said, okay. And above it, we can put a big sunroom. So we have an area in our house that has a more than 180 degree view from mountain to mountain.
That's awesome.
So we can see both mountain ranges across the city. It's beautiful. And directly underneath that is this octagon office that was built as my dream office. And I have all my nerd stuff on the walls and all my, you know, pictures that I've gotten from people and all my mushroom head masks and my dream theater paraphernalia and my, you know, everything that I've kind of collected, I finally have a place to put. And so I shut the door and it's my little domain. So anyway, that's, I put myself in my office and I really enjoy having a place of my own. And I think my family enjoys having a place of my own too.
Well, yeah, I mean, it gets you out of the way, you know, gets you out of everybody else's hair as much as, you know, people getting in your way. It's nice to kind of have a space to do that sort of stuff. For me, it's just a little 8x10 off my living room. I'm sure I've spoken about it on the show before.
Speaking of independent work that you've done, my oldest daughter and I both downloaded Holiday Heroes.
Oh, nice.
That we heard about last week. And she and I are having a competition to see who can get further along in the app.
Very cool. If you guys get to the point where, you know, she prints off a reward for leveling up and she colors it, let me know, because I'd like to see it.
Okay. I don't know if we have AirPrint. I don't know. How do you hook up a... We'll talk about this afterwards because it's all...
Well, it's
a tech call.
Yeah. So. Well, with Air... I mean, you could just email the thing to yourself. And then print it off that way. That would be the easiest thing to do. But yeah, I'm actually not familiar with how to print for mobile devices, but because I don't do it. I mean, I don't print anything. Everything I do is just saved as a PDF for, like, you know, accounting documents and stuff like that. Like, if I don't have to print something, I really try not to.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let's get into one topic that I know we have to talk about, because you would have to be under a rock to have missed this last week. And that is the new trailer from Star Wars, The Force Awakens. Did you see this?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it multiple times.
Multiple times, yeah. I have lost count. I don't know what viewing number I'm on, but it's
Did you see the George Lucas redo of it?
Yeah, the teaser, the mock-up of the George Lucas special edition trailer thing, where there's, like, just stuff everywhere. It was great. That was very funny. Like, and it's so funny that, I mean, when episode one came out, I mean, things on the internet were just getting going. Like, it was really not nearly as saturated as it is right now. But like minutes after that trailer was released, there were memes online of the lightsaber and like putting extra TIE fighters in and like all the stuff. And just mere moments after this thing is released. And on one hand, you know, I'm a little jealous of J.J. Abrams at the helm of the new Star Wars franchise. But also, that has got to be a terrifying job.
Oh, yeah. The expectations for episode one were so high that and even if Jesus had walked out of the screen and said, hey, here I am, I'm the Force, people would have been disappointed.
Yeah.
And knowing what he has to overcome and live up to must keep him awake at night.
Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah. And I mean, one of my favorite parts of this whole thing was the idea that the Millennium Falcon was not going to be in the movie. And he held on to that for as long as he could. And then eventually there was some sort of leak. There's some pictures. And then he did this great note, social media thing where he wrote a note saying, look, the Millennium Falcon is just not going to be in this movie. And the picture, of course, was taken on the chessboard in the Millennium Falcon set, which like any Star Wars fan was just really appreciated the humor behind it, right?
Yeah.
And it is probably the most important scene in this entire trailer is a flyby loop-de-loop of the Millennium Falcon with TIE fighters chasing it. Like, just, you know, like, it's just the poetic justice is just, he must be just enjoying every last minute of the giant nerdgasm that happened because everybody's expectations are low, like you said. And the combination of the imagery that I saw, the music, which just completely gets you going, and some of the cool visuals that they're teasing us with, like I am 100% on board. I saw it on Facebook. Somebody posted it on Facebook, and I started watching it. I stopped it. I was like, "What am I doing? I'm watching this on a 6x4 little video screen on my Facebook feed on my laptop. I have an Apple TV in the other room." So I went on to the Apple TV trailers and turned that on and watched it on my 46-inch television, which was a much better experience.
Oh, yeah.
And I kid you not, Hammond, at the moment when the Millennium Falcon did the loop-de-loop alone in my living room, I cocked my head sideways and said out loud, shut the fuck up. I was done. JJ had me at a minute and 12. Just, yep, I'm on board. I will go see it.
Two images got me. One, the X-Wings racing along above the water.
Yeah, very cool.
That was very, very, very cool. And say what you will about the hilt of that sword, the lightsaber. I freaking love it.
I think it's great. I don't know what everybody is having a cow about.
Yeah, I think the image of a laser hilt to go with your laser sword makes it very... like two-handed black knight broadsword kind of cool.
Well, it looks like a claymore. I mean, so here's the thing. I mean, what are the arguments that you've heard against this?
Lots of dumb things like, that's not practical. He'll cut his hand off. I'm like, ignoring the fact that it's a lightsaber in the first place. They're making all these practical arguments about it. I'm like, it's a freaking fantasy weapon.
Laser
Let
sword.
It go.
Doesn't exist. here's something else that's entirely, you know, everybody just loves Darth Maul's double-bladed lightsaber. Pretty most easy to cut your own leg off.
Also, the most impractical weapon on the planet.
Yeah, like there was a very nerdy YouTube video that I saw digging through one night, and this guy was talking about what would he choose as a lightsaber, and he broke down all of the different lightsaber-esque weapons that have existed.
And that guy has a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah, absolutely. But but it was informative, and it was well done. Had lots of cool concept art to illustrate his points, some images from Clone Wars, etc. And he outlined a couple of things that I didn't even know existed. I don't remember the names. I'm going to get them wrong. I mean, there's your standard lightsaber. There is your double-bladed lightsaber, a.k.a. Darth Maul. There is a light pike, which is an extra long handle with a shorter blade at the end. There is a light whip, which I've heard of but never actually seen.
Wasn't it one of the Clone Wars?
I think like maybe it was. Cartoon? Yeah, but I don't know if it was necessarily a light whip. I'm not sure if it was meant to be a lightsaber. Like, it wasn't used by a Jedi. I think it was just, like, something else.
Okay.
There is a short lightsaber, and I don't remember the name of it. It's much
like a Bowie knife.
It's like a dagger. Yeah, it looks like a little machete. Ahsoka uses it in Clone Wars, and she carries it upside down, so she uses it kind of like a dagger. So she's got one long blade in one hand and then the yellow short blade in the other, and it is badass. It looks amazing. And so he goes through all of this stuff, and he made like really kind of Well, if this was a real, like, just throw out the, you know, suspension of disbelief. If this was a real laser sword fight, then, you know, here's the reasons why you'd want to choose this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, this is great. You know, I really appreciated, you know, it's the kind of thing that you would do if you were playing Star Wars as a D&D tabletop kind of situation. You'd need to know these things would have to have some sort of parameter. Otherwise, you just can't decide who wins a fight. And he ended up choosing just a standard lightsaber, and he explained why, and that's fine. But I don't understand why people are crapping on the Claymore version in the J.J. Abrams trailer, because
I don't know.
The purpose of the hilt of a sword is to protect your hands against other people's attacks. Well, when the other attacks are from laser swords, it makes sense to have a laser hilt, because if you don't, the laser sword of the other guy is just going to cut through whatever you have. And you're going to lose fingers, right?
Or your hand, i.e. two other people.
Yeah, precisely. So I don't understand why people don't think it's cool. I think it's badass.
I mean, that might be Luke that we see, because he's learned his lesson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you never know. You never know. I don't see him carrying a red lightsaber. I don't see him going dark.
That's true. I forget about the color coding of good.
Yeah, that's the only thing. And it sounds like, I mean, someone brought up something that I thought was really interesting about the visuals of it, is that it didn't look very perfect. Like, it looked like there was a lot of flickering, some bolts kind of astray along the blade as it animates. And someone in some form or another, I don't remember what page I was on, suggested that it might be a flashback. Like, you might be looking at one of the, it's got a medieval look to it, right?
Yeah.
You know, it might be a flashback, you know, it might be a vision or something like that. And that I could see. It could be also, you know, a Sith Lord emerging and constructing his own lightsaber for the first time, not really having any rules to follow. Like, I really have no idea.
Yeah.
So why is it that you think, it's cool or not cool?
Okay, before I get into that, the one thing that I'm a little worried about is the Foxed fanfare that is such a part of the Star Wars soundtrack will not be there this time.
Could be a big Disney castle instead.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
And I it's a small thing, but when you hear that fanfare and then it goes to a long time ago, you know, that's part of what my DNA is.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm going to miss that more than... I need to prepare myself to be missing that.
Yeah, I'm surprised that no one's edited it in front of the trailer already. You know, I mean, they would get in some serious crap. I don't think that Disney would let that happen. But
yeah,
I'm okay. It doesn't really phase my experience, I don't think.
But overall, I the couple things that I thought were really cool is that it felt very Star Wars-y.
Mm-hmm, agreed.
It looked like all the other Star Wars films. And then it threw in, I know I complained about this on Grumpy Cast once, this forced nostalgia, like you did with the Millennium Falcon, like we did seeing the deserts of Tatooine. They were definitely playing to what we all wanted to see.
Oh, yeah. They want to fill this theater with 35-year-old nostalgic people. They don't necessarily want the people that are 20 that grew up with, you know, when they were like 8 and 10 and 12 with the prequels coming out. It really feels like Abrams is shooting at the people that grew up watching the original trilogy.
We saw the trailer. I saw it online a couple times, but then my wife and I went to go see the Hunger Games movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the trailer playing there. And when it ended, there were four people who got up and left the theater and made a very big point about how they bought their tickets just to watch the trailer.
Yeah. I don't necessarily... Yeah, I can't see myself really going to see a movie just for a trailer, but...
If you remember, Meet Joe Black was attached... was the movie that the Phantom Menace trailer was attached to.
Oh, was it?
And that movie made a boatload of money the weekend, and it had very little to do with Meet Joe Black.
Yeah, that was actually not a bad movie. Yeah, I didn't mind that one.
My expectations are still very metered because I've been burned before,
mm-hmm.
but I am more excited about it now than I was before I saw it.
Mm-hmm. I like what Abrams has done with Star Trek. So, I mean, he took what can be essentially a very slow, I won't say dull, but a different kind of pace
you know, for sci-fi with Star Trek, and he amped it up. I found it very entertaining. And he pays homage to characters in just enough, just the right way, you know, in conjunction with his actors, of course, that makes it feel nostalgic but brand new. And I've got a really good feeling about the experience and the chemistry between Hamill, Ford, and everybody else that's on board from the original cast. I'm sure the new people are going to be fine, but I think there's going to be just enough nostalgia and just enough new stuff for everybody to be in there. Plus, I mean, these days special effects are just so
special,
so good. You don't question how they did that. You're just kind of like, yep, this is awesome. And the fact that, like, there's little things that people are pointing out that, I mean, I noticed right away is that, like, in Return of the Jedi, the sensor dish gets knocked off the Millennium Falcon in the Death Star attack, mm-hmm. with Calrissian at the helm. Yep. And it's not on the ship. Like, they still haven't replaced it.
Oh, my gosh. That's really... Right? People are noticing those kind of details in 82-minute trailer or whatever it was?
It happened to me, but it happened really quick. I'm just kind of like, huh, that doesn't really look like the Millennium Falcon. Oh, right, the dish got knocked off. Because whenever you see it as a toy, it's always got the dish included.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? And it just me kind of like quickly processing all that kind of stuff. But I mean, like, I've seen those movies hundreds of times.
Actually, I broke the dish off one of my Millennium Falcon to have it match the Jedi one.
You're a purist, even when you're play acting. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, I was probably, I don't know, 6th, 7th grade, and I had one, and I'd just gotten finished. I'm like, well, this happened in the movie. Snap.
Hammond means business. Yeah, I'm very curious to see a slightly longer trailer. Like, I remember the excitement behind Man of Steel, the teaser trailer, and all it was just this little dot that was Superman flying up in the air and breaking the sound barrier, and I was just on the edge of my chair. And then the trailers that came out after that just really, really got everything going. So I'm looking forward to seeing some longer trailers for Star Wars, even though we got to wait like an entire year before it comes out.
Yeah. Actually really, wrapping up the movie conversation, I'm actually really looking forward to seeing the final Hobbit film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm curious to see how that one goes. And speaking of, Star Wars is going to be a Christmas release, I mean, I suppose Disney doesn't want to compete with all of the Avengers stuff that's going to be happening in the summer. So
now that they're all under the same umbrella, I think the Star Wars films are going to replace the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings films as the Christmas releases.
The Christmas release, yeah. That makes sense. You know, all the toys that go with Star Wars leading up to the Christmas release.
Oh, yeah.
It's like printing money, man. It's like printing money. Right. Well, while we're on Star Wars, I'll just jump in with one of the things that I did have time to watch this week off the top, which is Ralph McQuarrie, Tribute to a Master. It's a series of YouTube kind of mini documentaries, clips or part of a documentary film from 2012 that were in tribute to Ralph McQuarrie, the concept artist and visual designer that helped Lucas design the original Star Wars trilogy. You can find the link in our show notes. You can also do a quick Google search for Ralph McQuarrie, A Tribute to a Master, or Tribute to a Master, and you'll be able to find this no problem. It's on the Star Wars YouTube channel as well, yeah. There's a lot of Rebels stuff on there right now because of the new cartoon, but you can find this playlist. And it's basically just an interview with a bunch of people at ILM, with George Lucas, with people that continued on to do the design work on the original trilogy, and they're all just talking about McQuarrie, who passed away in 2012, and the stunning visual work that he did. And something that I never really considered, because I've been really influenced by McQuarrie's work for a long time, I have a series of limited edition prints that came with some book that my mom gave me when I was like 10. And I've always remembered those images because as a young kid, you're kind of confused because they don't look like C-3PO and R2-D2. Like, the X-Wings look like X-Wings, but they're a little bit different because it's all concept art. It's not exactly how they ended up being in the movie, but it's how everything started. And, because of that difference, those images stuck with me. And to hear these artists and other people in the industry talk about how he was the first concept artist to really do these kind of images and treat sci-fi like it wasn't shiny and new, give it this kind of edge, this grittiness, to tell stories in the paintings as much as he was designing something, it really, really opened my eyes to kind of the top of the pyramid where everything else is just kind of trickled down. You know, I mean, these days between
television, film, cartoons, and video games, the amount of concept art that is out there, and I'm just not just concept art, good concept art. There is a metric shit ton on the internet. It's a great way to lose a Friday night if you're into this stuff, to just go out and look for all kinds of really cool concept art. But you can really kind of start to see where it all began with Star Wars and Macquarie's work. So if you were at all interested in concept art and hearing about the kind of important backbone that it all has, then check out the Ralph Macquarie Tribute to a Master YouTube series. It's on the Star Wars YouTube channel.
I remember very vividly when I saw those pictures for the first time. I remember thinking that being confused a little bit because Darth Vader did not look a lot like Darth Vader, but it was familiar enough that I could go, oh, that's his Vader version.
Mm-hmm.
But Anthony Daniels tells a story in one of the making ofs. I wish I could tell you which one, but one of the making ofs about when he saw the picture of C-3PO and how that picture intrigued him so much that he felt like he had to have that part and be that person to figure out what was going on in that picture.
Yeah, and what's funny is that the final design looked very different compared to that the images that Macquarie had done of the droids. They were much more conceptual, much more free. Obviously, I think they were still thinking like we have to cast a person inside of this thing, so it had to have those kind of proportions. But it was much more feminine. There was a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say it looked a lot like the Metropolis.
Yeah, yeah. I was struggling to remember what the pop culture reference was, but yeah, it's a female name from Metropolis. The reference that they make in this documentary as well. And it's very cool. And there was a really cool point when all of the artists that are being interviewed talk about their favorite painting, their favorite famous Macquarie painting. And one of them mentioned mine, which is a very steep upshot of the AT-AT attack on Hoth. And you've got a snowspeeder that's been hit, smoking and flaming out of control, with another snowspeeder that's wrapping the legs of the AT-AT in the tow cable. And it's this crazy shot from what would have been, I guess, a person's perspective, you know, on the ground looking up at the AT-AT. And it's a wicked, wicked painting. And I highly encourage everybody to just do a quick Google search for Ralph Macquarie, and immediately you will recognize these images. You've seen them at some point in your geeky life. Right on. So what have you been watching this week, man?
I have been listening and been on the show enough that I felt like I had to watch Arrow and Flash.
Mm.
So since the last time I was on, I have caught up with Arrow and Flash.
On one part, I am extremely happy for you. On the other part, I feel really bad. Can you guess which one that I like better?
I know you're liking the Flash. My only problem that I have with the Flash is they've kind of fallen into bad guy of the week.
Yeah, Smallville did that too. And
I know it's only serving a greater cause to them to get to the arc.
Yep.
But they need to get to the arc quick, because if it's just going to be CSI, how do I beat this particular metahuman?
Yeah.
You're going to lose me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they did a good job with Barry Allen and his character development. But really, everybody else is kind of just filling the quota for the episode and the plot and how we beat the bad guy. You're right.
I am. It's interesting. The girl who plays the female scientist, the one that had her fiance supposedly die in the accident.
Yep.
Who I know he's going to show back up again. So that's why I said supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
She played Leela in the movie Sky High.
Okay.
And she could control plants in the movie.
Interesting.
I highly recommend seeing Sky High. It's about it's a high school for superheroes. It's got Bruce Campbell. It's got Linda Carter. It's got a guy in there whose mom was a good guy and dad is a bad guy, and his name is War and Peace. It's really good. It's very funny. In fact, the building from Sky High is the same design as the nerd school from Hero 6.
Nice.
So there's that. And also, the guy who's in the wheelchair, he played JD's brother on Scrubs. So I watched him as JD's brother get drunk in a bathtub, and then an hour later, I'm watching him work with Barry Allen to save the world.
The professor kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah. But I'm really enjoying The Flash. I still hold firm to my belief that the sun never shines in Arrowland.
Yeah.
And it needs to, because Batman is dark and gritty. The Arrow is darn right, you know, daylight savings time dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's tough to kind of, there's no joy in that city.
There's no laughs in that series. There's every once in a while you get a little chuckle now with like a Felicity joke or something. Or really it's more about the Brandon Routh, the guy that's playing the Atom, and the character's name is escaping me right now, but there used to be Arrow used to be a pretty funny show.
Yes, it was.
And they've lost that. And one of the biggest non-funny things about Arrow is Laurel. She needs to go. I tweeted about this earlier this week. I cannot stand the actor, the character, the writing for her is just bad. Like, I'm not an actor. I would probably be terrible on TV. I feel like she should just cut her losses. They should just give her another part on a different show. I'm sure that she'd be fine. The character has just been written to a corner that's just really, really uninteresting, and it is a one-trick pony. And she's a fairly attractive girl, and she can't frown. She looks put on, and she's just frowning all the time. So she just looks like she's got this fake pout constantly, yeah. And it drives me nuts. I feel nothing for Laurel and her situation.
I'm trying to figure out where they're going, why they're trying to go with her.
Well, I mean, spoiler alert, her sister died in the first episode, and this whole season has been about Sarah dying. What should have happened? Laurel should have been shot. And it should have been Sarah going off the deep end as an assassin trying to find Laurel's killer. That would have been interesting.
Speaking of that, I love what they're doing with his sister.
Thea.
Thea,
yeah. He calls her Speedy from time to time, and that's why I was blanking on the name. The thing that I dislike about what they did with Thea is, like, now she's like this badass samurai. After 5 months in the tropics with her dad. Like, Oliver goes away for like 7 years and comes back with some pretty good skills that he constantly has to train for. And Thea goes away for a couple months and she comes back as a complete badass. Nah.
I like what they're doing. They're making her more interesting. She was always she always kind of filled the damsel in distress role, kind of like Laurel does.
A little bit, yeah.
And now that she's no longer filling that role, I like what they're doing better.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish that Malcolm Merlyn had died when they thought he died. Like, I really wish that had wrapped up. That was a great arc, you know, end of season, end of story. I wish they could have just let it be. The thing that I was pointed out to by reading a Mashable article earlier today was how the two series are different. And how most of Arrow's villains are very much grounded in reality. Like, they're just basically highly trained people. They're not necessarily superpowered. And it has to be a little bit more grounded in reality. And I feel like because The Flash, even though it is kind of villain of the week, super villain of the week, it allows them to at least be a little bit lighter. You know, it allows them to be a little bit lighthearted about things. And they can make jokes. They can give them goofy names. They can joke about locking them up in this fancy prison underneath, you know, Star Labs that no one knows about. But I wish they would just do that with Arrow, not necessarily introduce supervillains that with superpowers, but just get to a point where they can roll forward with the characters. They're stuck on this plot line that just needs to wrap up and move on. Hopefully it's resolved by the mid-season break. I watched the Flash episode from last night, which is the first of a two-parter of the Flash Arrow crossover.
Oh.
So some of the cast members from Arrow are on this episode of Flash. And I mean, well, it's not a great spoiler. It's Diggs, Oliver, and Felicity. And right away, it's the best episode of Arrow all season. Why? Because but all the characters that you care about are interesting and that you want to see more of are the only ones from Arrow in this episode, right? It's the three people that matter the most. It's the three people that have the most interesting kind of backstory. They're the deepest characters. They're the ones that you want to know about. And it was balanced with the characters that you really like in The Flash. So it worked out really, really well. I'm curious to see now on the next episode of Arrow, where there will be a Flash crossover, apparently, as this storyline continues, if adding Flash and maybe some of his sidekicks into the Arrow situation will lighten up Arrow and maybe open up a little bit more as to what they should do as far as, you know, how the character should act and what the plot and writing should be. And I hope they nail it. It's the same producer, same network, so they've got an opportunity, and I hope they get it right, and I hope they learn from it, because I'm the only reason I am still watching Arrow is because I knew this crossover was coming and I wanted to be caught up.
The only thing I can say about Arrow, kind of in closing, I think, would be that I want to see more Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of Michael Jai White. I like that concept of that. That allows them to be a little bit more flippant and maybe kind of funny at even the Arrow's expense.
Yep.
And that, I want to see more of that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think we will see more as the Flash matures as a series. I think they will start to see, I wouldn't be surprised if the Flash overtakes the Arrow in popularity and that they have to kind of backtrack on the Arrow and kind of reset and see what's going. I wouldn't be surprised if that unfortunately does take the rest of the season, as some of the actors are probably in there on a contract for the whole season.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's the difference about with TV and movies. In a movie, you can just kind of write a story around a specific 2-hour plot, whereas in a TV series, you kind of have to sign people on for X amount of shows, and it gets complicated, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I was watching is another YouTube series, which I won't talk too much about because it's really hard to explain. You just have to kind of go and watch it. And that's Lords of War. It is, I've been watching them as they've been coming out, but I recently sat down and watched them all in a row. And it's from Blizzard Entertainment, and they are a series of short cinematics leading up to the Warlords of Draenor expansion that just came out last month. And they explain the background of the major villains and bosses that are going to be happening in this World of Warcraft expansion. And even if you're not a Warcraft player, or if you were and you're not anymore, which is my case, watch these on the Blizzard Entertainment YouTube channel. Warlords of Draenor has some really interesting story. The way that they communicate these ideas and these stories is through limited animation, through digital painting, with music and effects and voiceover, so there's a narration, and it's beautiful artwork. The stories are really compelling. The backstory of these warlords, which are all orcs, and how they became the monsters that you're going to deal with in the game, are really, really intricate, and they're very, very well done. And I would highly recommend that you check these out if you are at all into fantasy. Dungeons and Dragons, you know, orcs and goblins and trolls and all that kind of stuff. Check out Lords of War on YouTube. Have you seen these, Hammett?
I have not. I have it bookmarked. Blizzard sent me an email a while back and said, hey, this is the last episode. Make sure you can watch it and get caught up so you're ready to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I saved the email because it sounds like something I would enjoy watching. I actually sat down and watched all of the trailer cinematics for all of the different releases in a row, and although I'm not a WoW player, that really made me want to be for about 2 days. I contemplated it.
Yeah, they jazz you up. They really kind of get you going. These ones are less of a hurrah, I want to go play Warcraft. It's more of a instant respect for the depth of the world that they've created over the last 20 years. Did you see the Burdens of Xiaohao? Did you see those?
Which one is that? Is that the...
It's the same idea. They created it was their first kind of venture into this kind of storytelling, and that was for the Mists of Pandaria expansion from 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Years ago.
I'm really new to the Blizzard world. I've only been in the Blizzard world since Hearthstone has been released for the iPad.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So my knowledge of anything Blizzard is from listening to the first 15 or 20 minutes of the instance and then playing Hearthstone.
Mm-hmm. Right. You'll like these. I mean, you're talking about The Hobbit and talking about the stuff that I know that you like, I think you'll just enjoy them. Because it's a great thing. You don't miss out on anything having not played the game at all, ever. Okay. Like they set it up pretty well that, you know, you get the characters' names, you get the kind of situation, and you don't really need to know much more than what they're telling you in the video, which is really cool. And in addition, there are also some behind the scenes. There's two, one about the story and one about the artwork.
Okay.
Yeah. Definitely worth checking out.
Can I throw in one more thing that I was watching?
Sure.
Actually, two quick ones. Hulu, they're both Hulu original series. One is called Behind the Mask, and it was a documentary series about mascots. And they followed a high school mascot. They followed a college mascot who was at UNLV. Mm-hmm. They followed a semi-pro mascot who was for a hockey team. And then they had the Milwaukee Bucks mascot. And they kind of followed their season, kind of. And it was incredibly interesting learning about the lives of mascots. And I was shocked at how interesting it was.
Huh.
My wife and I watched it, and we both felt a little bad for the high school student. And we really just wanted to see a story about the pro mascot, because he was super good, super dynamic. And, you know, some of the things he was doing, you know, the putting his body on the line to be acrobatic in this goofy outfit and stuff. Yeah. Very interesting stuff. And then the other thing was another Hulu original series called The Wrong Mans, and it's a British show. And basically the concept is guys walking on the street, car loses control, gets into an accident. He calls the police. The police come, take the car away. As he's continuing to walk, phone rings, he picks it up, and it says, if you're not here by 5, we will kill your wife. Now, it's not him that they're talking about, but he somehow gets pulled into this world of intrigue and espionage and... You know, police and spies and all this kind of stuff. And it's very funny. And I'm 2 or 3 episodes in, and I'm really, really enjoying it.
It's called The Wrong Man?
Yeah, The Wrong Mans. Okay. M-A-N-S.
Mans,
The Wrong
okay. Mans. With an S, okay. And the other one was Behind the Mask.
Uh-huh.
For the mascot uh-huh. documentary. Cool.
Yep.
Very cool. So one of the things that you and I were discussing, I guess, over the course of the week leading up to this episode was this geeky franchise list that you had found, I guess, online?
Somewhere? No, it was a magazine I actually bought. Actually, in preparation for the show, hey, this is something Joel and I could talk about.
Sure. Well, we were talking about it a little bit pre-show as I was ambling about with some technical difficulties. So why don't we dive in? Maybe we can just kind of quickly touch on the first 2/3, but then maybe discuss the top 10.
Okay, I'll just burn through the... Let me find the list, and I'll just burn through the... Where is it?
Yeah, what magazine was it from?
It's called Geek Out, The Ultimate Guide Through the Nerdverse.
These things always scare me because they usually get it wrong.
Hang on, I'm trying to find the master list. I sent it to you, didn't I?
I thought you sent it to me in an email, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, it's Princess Bride, Dexter, I'm going backwards from 30... My Little Pony, Battlestar Galactica, Minecraft, Studio, how do you say it?
Oh, Ghibli? Yeah.
Yeah. Adventure Time, Transformers, Avatar, The Last Airbender. Number 20 is Big Bang Theory. 19 is Sherlock. Let's see. The Tim Burton verse falls at number 18.
And you and I had a little bit of a discussion in this in the pre-show, too. I wish they would just focus on a particular movie or a particular franchise. Saying the Tim Burton verse really doesn't narrow it down.
Yeah, and that happens a few times in this list.
Yeah, because he's got some gems, and he's got some stinking turds as well.
Yeah, oh yeah. Number 17 is The Walking Dead.
Figured that one would be in there.
16, Dungeons & Dragons. 15, Chronicles of Narnia. J.J. Abrams' verse is number 14.
Yeah, see, again, really vague.
Breaking Bad, the Whedonverse.
So is this Geeky Franchises? Is that what the name of this thing was?
It's the most epic, 30 most epic fandoms of all time.
Oh, fandoms. Okay, they don't specify geeky, because, I mean, Breaking Bad is great, but it doesn't strike me as a geeky show.
It's in the magazine, it's called Geek Out, and it's called the 30 most epic fandoms of
fandoms,
all time.
Fandoms, okay. All right.
Then Zelda... Okay, and then top 10. Here we go.
All right.
Pokemon is number 10.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't know anything about it except for I choose you, Pikachu. I don't know anything beyond that.
Yeah, I know nothing. And a lot of the art that I see online from some younger artists, it's just all nostalgic Pokemon stuff, and it's all well done, and it's very popular. They get lots of comments, lots of hits, lots of shares, and I just don't understand. And it's because I missed it. It's just, I was just too old. Like, when Pokemon was crazy, I was 5 or 10 years out. Like, it just wasn't my thing.
Yeah, and the strategy card games, the physical strategy card games, has been something I've never done. So I don't know anything about that. Oh, speaking of games, tell me a little bit about your D&D experience from last week.
Oh, right. That was in there, what, like 17 or 18 or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. I joined a couple of friends that do a Sunday night game. I rolled, I don't have a name for him yet. I'm still working on it because I had to roll the character quickly because I had a busy week. So I had to kind of get going and join the game. But I have a very large dragonkin, which is essentially a dragon kind of human form character. Over 6 feet tall, probably over 250 pounds. They're just big monstrous guys, which is awesome. Suits my personality, and because that's what I always go with whenever I'm making a character in an RPG, I tend to kind of go with like the big thug, for fun. And what else? Oh, I'm carrying a maul, so it's a great big hammer, which is funny because you think dragons, you think kind of like horns and spikes and blades, and a lot of people kind of go to the broadsword, but I went to the maul.
Well, you talked about in the last episode how you're a big blunt instrument guy.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing, like with Overwatch, like I was really drawn to Reinhardt, the guy with the rocket sledgehammer, and that's essentially the kind of attitude and character that I've brought to this Dragonborn. I'm new to D&D, people. Forgive me if I'm getting some of the terminology wrong. But as far as the rest of the character, he's an outlander. As far as his personality type and background, he's a fighter, which is akin to like a warrior in World of Warcraft. So he's just a hand-to-hand combat guy. It's not very much for spells. And a champion was the type of fighter that he was, which, again, boils everything down to physical ability. There's no spell casting. There's no paladin type stuff. It's just kind of like what you have on you, what your wits are, and how hard you hit the other guy. So it's a great kind of intro for me to get into D&D, because the other characters, the other people that I'm playing with, have got some more robust kind of, like, one's a cleric, so it's all spells all the time. Somebody else is kind of like a rogue character. Another character is, I want to say like a paladin, but he's a halfling, so he's got this weird kind of over-the-top attitude. It's a really fun crew. And what's funny is that there's two halflings, a small human woman, I think, and a dwarf. So the dragonkin, or the dragonborn that I made, is ginormous by comparison, which is kind of fun. I've really been enjoying it. I think there's another dragonborn in the group, but she wasn't there this week. So I haven't had a chance. We haven't had a chance to do, like, you know, double dragon. Pardon the 80s pun, on some bad guys. But I joined the crew. I did the adventure with them. It was really cool because they had to write me into the story. Like, they had to kind of like go to the tavern and meet me and bring me on board. It was an interesting way to kind of join a game already in progress. And then we had to go into a fight, and that was really cool. So I had some experience having done some tabletop Star Wars, before at Nerdtacular a couple years ago. And, I'm looking forward to doing this on a regular basis. I'm going to be working really hard throughout the week to free up a couple hours on Sunday night to go hang out with people in the flesh and kind of share this experience. It should be fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad. All right. So number 9 is The Hunger Games.
Yeah, I can see that.
I enjoyed the third movie.
Third movie? Yeah, I really liked the second one.
Yeah. Number 8 is Harry Potter. The Harry Potter franchise.
Harry Potter, yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Number 7 would be the Lord of the Rings franchise.
Hmm. I would have expected that to be higher.
Yeah, but as it gets higher, you start to realize it's actually a relatively appropriate... Well, this next one kind of throws me. Game of Thrones is number 6.
Yeah, they've been books long before they've been a TV show. But I can... I feel like Lord of the Rings should be above Game of Thrones.
Now, here's where the conversation is going to come in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Episode or number 5 is DC Comics, and number 4 is Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Because I think that, I don't know exactly how they chose the ranking, but I'm sure that there are people who are going to think that the DC should come before or be higher ranked than
in terms of Marvel would fandom, be. Yeah. I mean, like, are they talking about like ravenous fans or number of fans?
I don't know. I haven't really gotten into each of the articles yet because I've been kind of waiting for the conversation first.
Yeah. So. Not to mention that if you say DC Comics, like, that's ginormous. Like, that, I mean, I feel like you have to kind of maybe even split off into the heroes, like Superman, Batman. Like,
yeah.
Those are going to be like the Superman, Batman, Justice League are going to be like the big DC kind of flagships. And then you've got Spider-Man, X-Men, and the Avengers as like the big Marvel stuff. But like, you can't really, I don't know. I really don't feel like you can group them all under one umbrella.
Yeah. It's hard. It's because some of the individual characters or franchises in their own right.
Yeah.
Number three is Doctor Who. And that's something I'm completely illiterate in. So I have no idea.
You and me both. I know that it's very popular and that people that are into it are very into it. So I can see it being up there. I'm surprised it's above the comics, but yeah.
Here is more controversy. Number two is Star Wars.
Boo. Number one, baby.
You know what number one's going to be?
Star Trek.
Yep, exactly.
I cheated. I remember the email that you sent me. I saw the top three. but yeah, no, that these two at the top does not surprise me, and I can only imagine the debate at this magazine editor desk when they were trying to decide between which one of these two was going to be number one.
Well, and also, the top 10 in general probably came down to some fights.
Yeah, there might have been fisticuffs there.
Because
about nerd fights here, I guess.
I could easily see the top three being lined up as Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Star Trek.
Yeah.
And then you get Harry Potter people in there. I mean, the top five I could see really being a fight. And then, like we were talking about earlier with the DC Marvel, the decision to lump them as DC and Marvel instead of Spider-Man, Batman, you know, that kind of thing, that was probably a decision that had to be made as well.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that these aren't separate fan groups.
No, it's all like the top 10, 90, well, I'd say 80% of them are me.
Yeah.
Take out Pokemon and my knowledge of Doctor Who, and you've got me.
Yeah, I mean, even if you just focus them down into groups, I mean, you're going to have the same people that really like Lord of the Rings also like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
You know, and if you had two people, you know, or one person that was a huge fan of both and said, hey, choose, I think they would have an answer, but it would not be just really quick. Like, I feel like they would have to think about that, you know, because
it's like asking anybody what their favorite movie is. Yeah. We might have something we have a go-to answer for, like Army of Darkness is my go-to answer.
Sure.
But then you start the conversation of, well, if you really want a good word joke movie, then you got to watch Clue. And if you want something that's a good solid story, then you have to watch this. And I mean, then it starts getting into the minutia of it, but everyone has their go-to answer.
Yeah. And it's all about mood too. I mean, like I watch like if I'm in mood A and I need to watch a movie and just kind of forget the world, I mean, maybe I throw Man of Steel in. If I'm in mood B, maybe I'm watching Castaway. Very different films. You know, and they're still both high on my charts of good movies that I own that I watch over and over again. You know, like it's tough when you come into that kind of realm. I feel like they're pretty close with having Star Wars, Star Trek, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings. I wish they were more specific, as you said, with the superhero stuff. I feel like Superman and Batman would be high. I don't necessarily know that they'd be in the top 10, though. Because there's a lot of people that like sci-fi and fantasy that are not big comic people.
And that might be one of the reasons why they decided to lump it together.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's missing off that list?
What?
Disney.
Yeah, that's true. Disney is missing.
And if they're going to talk about franchises, I mean, talk about something that trumps everybody. Not so much, you know, in terms of personal taste, but more just, you know, the number of fans and the amount of nostalgia. When you just say Disney animated movies as kind of a giant franchise, I mean, you're talking about a lot of movies that affected a lot of people.
Well, yeah, if you can use the Whedonverse and the JJ verse and the Burton verse, then you better put in the Disneyverse.
The Walt Disneyverse, yeah, sure. I mean, and that goes to include a lot of stuff. I mean, that's Pirates of the Caribbean. That's, you know, every animated film. That's Pixar. Like, Pixar is not on the list. Stuff like that is a little bit, you can become kind of hard-pressed, you know, when you start lumping things together, because then you have to do it for everybody.
There was a similar magazine that came out around Halloween for the 50 scariest films of all time.
See, that, and at least you have a single genre.
Yeah, and it was interesting, though, because I think, personally, there were about 10 films that were put on there that shouldn't have been, and about 10 films that were left off that should have been there.
Yeah.
And I think these books are fun because they start conversations like this. I don't think they're trying to be definitive. I think they're conversation starters.
Mm.
This is something you buy for like a road trip, and you start the conversation, and then 6 hours later, you're in Las Vegas.
Yeah, you wait until you're out of the city. You're doing smooth cruise control highway driving. Everybody's got a coffee.
Yep.
And then you just kind of dive in.
Yeah, you turn the music down a little bit, and then you say, hey, I got this book. And then all of a sudden, you're having relatively healthy nerd debate over Princess Bride even being on the list.
Yeah, and you get somebody in the backseat going, nope, you're wrong.
Nope. With their arms folded.
Yep, wrong. La 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 la. I can hear you. Yeah. Yeah. So where do you fall as far as Star Wars and Star Trek?
I used to be, I had mentioned this on the Coverthon, because Daryl and I were on.
Oh, cool.
And I started out very, very hardcore Star Wars. There was a period of time in my life, though, where I switched and I started really enjoying the deeper world of Star Trek.
Mm.
And the more fleshed out characters and the more nuance in their universe. And I'm not saying Star Wars isn't nuanced, but there's something about maybe the maturity of storytelling, because I see Star Wars very much as a fantasy morality kind of tale. And I see Star Trek as more of a world.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yep.
And some of the philosophies in Star Trek appeal to me more than I've gotten older. And so I'm probably 60-40 more Star Trek than I am Star Wars, but I by no means turn my nose up at anything Star Wars. If I have the opportunity to watch Star Wars, I will sit down and watch it.
Mm. Yeah, see, and I'm the opposite. To make it a very simple statement, I find Star Wars has a lot more imagination than Star Trek.
Yeah, that's I do agree with you on that.
Yeah, and that's why I think that just personally appeals to me. That's not to say that I don't like Star Trek. Because I like the movies, you know, like I really enjoyed watching The Next Generation with my dad growing up. Like I like Picard and that whole Next Generation crew. Can't say that I was super big on the spinoffs. I did watch Voyager a lot in university, but that's because it was on at dinner time on reruns. Like it was just there. Chad, who used to be on the Citadel Cafe with me and has been my best friend for a long time, really enjoyed Deep Space Nine, especially the later seasons. I remember him telling me a lot about that. Because it got very action-packed, like it got very war-related, which is stuff that he likes. So I can respect, you know, Star Trek, and I do enjoy it, but I don't go out of my way to watch it. Whereas Star Wars, I've just always been a fan, and I think it's probably because I've been watching Star Wars longer. Like, I didn't get into Star Trek until I was a teenager, whereas Star Wars was just like from the moment that I was old enough to watch those films, my dad, you know, showed me Return of the Jedi, and I was just like, yep, I'm on board.
See, I remember very distinctly watching Star Trek as a kid, really young. It was already in syndication, and I remember very distinctly watching that. And then I saw Star Wars, and of course I was all in. And I was all in through the Jedi, and then got super excited with Phantom Menace. But by the time Phantom Menace had come out, the way I saw the world had changed. So the Phantom Menace and those movies, although were crap, still had some magic to them for me.
Yeah.
But the way they're told and the people in them and maybe that fantasy aspect was a little bit much for me. So by then, I don't know. It's a weird thing to try to describe because I love them both. But if I had to pick a side, I'd probably stand on the Star Trek side.
Yeah. If you want to erase some of the disdain that you have, dear listener, for the prequels as a Star Wars purist, watch the series, all six, in any order you want, but preferably like the machete order or, you know, an alternate order, with someone that has never seen them or has only ever seen them once or twice and doesn't really remember them that well. Because all of the things that you pick up on that drive you nuts will just not matter to the person sitting next to you. And you get a lot more out of it when they really enjoy it. and you can just kind of bite your tongue and not say, oh my God, Jar Jar drives me nuts, and just let them say, yeah, yeah, Jar Jar wasn't great, but they're not as like, he must die, you know, as the rest of the nerdverse out there. And that is something that has kind of reopened my eyes to, not so much episode one, but at least episode two and three, I can appreciate and still enjoy watching. Episode three is actually pretty good when you get past a couple of little glitches, but and they're better when you're watching them bookended by the original series. So you go episode five, episode four, episode five, episode two, episode three, episode six. And it starts and ends with the good ones. You just get a little bit of backstory in there. And it feels much more complete at that point. And I highly recommended checking it out.
We actually were talking about the Chronicles of Narnia earlier. And they actually they've reordered the books recently. When I was a kid. Yeah, when I was a kid. It started with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, that's how I started too.
And number three was The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But number six was The Magician's Nephew, which was the story of how the wardrobe was built where it came from.
I didn't know there was six books. I thought there was only
actually,
three.
There's seven. Seven, actually. Oh, geez. Yeah. The Last Battle is super sad. I've read it once and I cried, and I haven't gone back to read it, even though I've read the series multiple times.
Yeah.
But now they've reordered the book, so The Magician's Nephew is actually first. And I don't like that because I like having this mysterious world that I'm in, and then there's some explanation later. So maybe this series lineup that you've given might be something I could dive into maybe with my kids.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it cuts out episode one altogether. You don't have to cut it out, but it's the idea is that you go through Star Wars and Empire Strike Back, and then right at the moment where you find out that Vader is Luke's father, you then go back and learn Vader's story. And then it's just up to you whether you start with episode one when he's a little kid, or will you start with episode two where he's being trained by Obi-Wan. And it's a much clearer connection because you just get to see Obi-Wan's spirit talk to Luke on Dagobah, and then you're doing a flashback back to Coruscant with Obi-Wan and Vader Anakin standing in an elevator going up to see Padme. Like it really makes a lot more sense.
I wouldn't mind skipping. The only reason I don't want to skip number one is because of Darth Maul.
On the pod racing scene is actually really fun.
Yeah, that's good too. And if you have a really good sound system, it really does make your kidneys dance.
Yeah, and there's some really fun moments for kids in episode one. I mean, kids are going to love it. Like, it's going to do its job, which is to excite another generation about Star Wars, right? I've done the Machete Order, and I really quite enjoyed it. I guess the only thing left to say about like Star Wars versus Star Trek is I find the pace. You really can't compare them.
No.
You know, we were talking about moods earlier. Like, if you want to watch an action movie, you go Star Wars. If you want to watch something more esoteric, you watch Star Trek. It's a lot more about like questioning what's out there, what could be, what can we do? Which I enjoy, but I don't necessarily always want that kind of an experience.
Well, that was one of the arguments people have between the series and the movies, is especially the Next Generation ones, is in the Next Generation movies, they try to make them more action-y movies, and then on TV, they're all cerebral and pensive and not as let's grab guns and blow people up kind of stuff. But the movies had to be because they're movies.
Well, and they're bigger budgets too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and you watch the first few episodes, first couple seasons of Generation, it's bad. It's really campy. They did not have a large following at that point.
No.
Right on. Well, we should probably move into the Internet Minute at the bottom of the show, and this is sponsored by Tweaked Audio. You can visit tweakedaudio.com for high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds. Use our code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off of your entire order. Coven seven different styles, mic'd sets available, compatible with all kinds of different MP3 players and different devices. And there's also a lifetime warranty. So for 30% off your order, free shipping, use the code TCC at the checkout at tweakedaudio.com. My pick this week is going to be pretty easy. It's Laurel D. Austin's portfolio site. And she is one of, if not the main artist behind Blizzard's Lord of War series, which I mentioned earlier in the show. The series was directed by Doug Alexander, but on her blog, Laurel had this to say. I developed the art style with that direction, referring to Doug Alexander, and integrated slash designed the characters' environments, trying to do something interesting within the Warcraft universe that's true to the game, but also, hopefully, working in its own context. In the end, it took over a year and a whole lot of other people. So she's quick to point out that there was a whole other team, but she was, as far as I can tell, integral in the way that Lords of War looks and feels as a completed story. She contributes to Hearthstone and other franchises at Blizzard as well. She's a very talented illustrator and painter. And the coup d'etat, which really caught my attention, is that she earned her Bachelor of Fine Arts at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design right here in Halifax, which I thought was really cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. Kind of a nod from home all the way at Blizzard. So check out Laurel D. Austin's portfolio. It's at laureldaustinart.com. She has some fantastic artwork up on her blog. Well, and her, of course, her portfolio site is right there when you land as well.
For me, I've made no qualms that I'm learning how to play the Chapman stick, which is this incredible 10-stringed instrument. On my show, I try to interview a stick player a month.
Wow.
And they're all been amazing. One of the ones that I've been fascinated with is a guy named Nick Beggs. And he used to be in the band Kaja Gugu, you know, the Too Shy, that one-hit wonder from the 80s. He was in that band.
No, but sure.
If you hear it, you'd know it.
Okay.
It was ubiquitous. Anyway, he does this song called Darkness in Men's Hearts, or Of Men's Hearts. I can't remember. Anyway, it's just a solo stick piece, and it's amazing. And I actually thought about it after I was on the last episode I don't know was with you, because we talked about musical instruments and that kind of thing. And I went back and listened to this, and I thought, you know what? I need to share this, because this is an amazing piece of music by an amazing artist on an amazing instrument.
So the Chapman stick, I mean, forgive me if we've not talked about this enough when you've been on. I mean, I barely even know what this is. Like, I'm Wikipedia-ing it right now.
Okay, so what it is about 40 years ago, a man named Emmett Chapman was a jazz guitar player, and he took his guitar and he kind of inverted it so it was vertical instead of horizontal. Mm-hmm. And he started tapping on the neck. And as it evolved, he developed this new technique of playing called freehands. And then he developed an instrument to go along with it. And it comes in these variety of flavors. I have a 10-string railboard and a 10-string rosewood. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's divided in two parts. You've got the bass side, and you've got the melody side. And it's kind of as if a piano and a guitar had a baby. Because you just tap on it. You don't strum it. You don't fret it. You just tap on the instrument. So if you want to hear a note, as one of them said, you just point to it and it happens.
Okay.
And it's logically laid out. It's incredibly versatile. It really reflects the artist as well as any instrument I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been taking lessons off and on for about 2.5 years. And I'm not very good, but every time I pick it up, I feel like I'm smart and that I'm doing something worthwhile with my brain.
Wow. Very cool. And I'm just realizing now that in your Skype picture, you're holding it.
Yeah.
Okay. It makes a lot more sense once you've seen a picture. Yeah. No, I mean, like, I sort of got it, but I'm just like, it's crazy when you think about all the different musical instruments that are out there that are not mainstream, you mm-hmm. know, or that are mainstream or have their own mainstream that most people don't know about. Yeah, it's really cool.
But this Nick Beggs piece is a great demonstration of what the instrument can sound like when it's in the hands of someone who's really, really good.
Right. Do you have any recordings of stuff that you've done?
I've got a few things on my SoundCloud page. Just search Jay Hammond C on SoundCloud. Hmm. Like I said, I'm not great, but I've done a few things.
I'll let the listeners be the judge of that. You might have just volunteered a link to your SoundCloud page.
I'm kind of Jay Hammond C everywhere. I think if people really want to look, it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah, that's what I tell people too. If they just Google Joel Duggan, it usually comes up.
Yeah. I kind of corner the market on Jay Hammond C.
Rightly so. We all have to corner the right user handles on all the social media.
Yeah.
It helps when you're the same or close to the same across the board. I've had to insert a middle initial in some places, and it drives me crazy because then people can't find me, or they find there's another Joel Duggan out there. There's several, and they're all in creative fields. There's a sculptor and a photographer, and they're both in the U.S. And I get mixed up often, I think, when people are looking for one and they find the other.
It seems like DeviantArt is the place where you have to make the most adjustments to names.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like a lot of people have come in and already squatted on certain things at DeviantArt.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a, and the DeviantArt's been around for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that any of the ones do anything bad. It's just a,
yeah.
It's kind of like getting an AOL handle when it, after you had been out for a few years, you're going to be, I was going to be Hammond 63 because there are already 62 other Hammonds on AOL.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm lucky in that I've been able to nab my first and last name in most places. A lot of that comes from working from home and kind of having your ear to the ground on social media. And when something new comes out, like back when Instagram first came around, or, you know, when I got into to Facebook and they were going to allow people to have their own domains, I was really quick to grab them for professional reasons. Right on. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on the citadelcafe.com/live, unless my computer doesn't do what it's told, like tonight. Our mobile audio stream is provided by alphageekradio.com. You can listen to the show live on Alpha Geek Radio, even when you are away from your computer. Point your mobile device to mobile.alphageekradio.com. That works for other shows too. They've got this great feature that takes all of the podcasts that do live episodes and puts them into reruns over the course of the week when there's not a live episode going. So tune into mobile.alphageekradio.com for all of your geeky podcast needs.
Yeah, Beyond the Playlist and Grumpycast are on there in reruns.
Nice. Nice. I didn't realize that you guys were on there as well. Music for this show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and of course, the episode will be available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com. That is also where you will find the show notes and links to the cool things that Hammond and I have talked about this week. Email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything that I am up to online at joelduggan.com. That includes my latest College Humor article. The Holiday Heroes app is hopefully going to be posted this week on my website that I did with John Beck and his business partner. Please also check out my Patreon page. That is where you can go to support my comic work as well as this podcast. I'm adopting a value-for-value model with both. So if you're enjoying what you're hearing, go to patreon.com/joelduggan and see what rewards are in store for you. You can also find me on Twitter and Tumblr with just Joel Duggan. Where can people find you online, Hammond?
I am jhammondc on Twitter. I am at jhammondc.com. I do a show that comes out every Sunday and the occasional Wednesday called Beyond the Playlist, where I interview creative artistic types about the process and their inspirations. And then I do Grumpycast with Daryl Skeels, the Trek Nerd, that comes out. We have another one tomorrow night we're doing.
Nice. I like the Grumpycast a lot. I do find it. It releases my inner nerd rage in a way that is safe for the general public.
It's a fun show to do because Daryl and I are both relatively nice people, I think. And then hearing us complain goofily about just random things is fun. It's cathartic and it's funny all at the same time.
You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. Star Wars.
Star Trek.
Star Wars.
Star Trek.
Star Wars. The Force has spoken.
Star-crossed. I win.